Hello, everyone. Welcome to Supernatural Junkies. I'm Super Alex.
I'm Dr. Kevin, and I am natural today.
I guess that means that I will be the junkie.
He is definitely got a lot of junk.
Wait a minute. I think there might be somebody else here.
Yeah, don't leave me off.
Who's that?
Who's that?
Who is that?
This is Dr. Dozier, and I'm lifting it up spiritually.
That's right.
He's pumping you up spiritually.
Yeah, pump you up.
We are here.
And we are...
The Supernatural
Junkies.
Wondered how you could get your hands on some awesome Supernatural Junkies gear? Well, the answer to that is it's now available on redbubble.com. We have a shop on there for Supernatural Junkies, and there's t-shirts, leggings, sweatshirts, hoodies, even a shower curtain. So if you've always wanted to have a shower curtain with Dr. Kevin on it, you can just get one with just Dr. Kevin. We have our logo on there on everything. And we also have all of us as singles. You can get magnets, stickers, you name it. It's all available on our Redbubble shop. I will be posting a link to that in our show notes for the last few episodes and from this point forward. If you have any questions about anything, you want to contact us, you can do so at supernaturaljunkies@gmail.com. Thanks, guys.
I'm Alex and I'm super.
I'm Dr. Thomas Dozier and I am also super. Hi, I'm Dr. Dennis, and I am the natural.
Hey, I'm Dr. Kevin. That makes me the junkie. Oh, yeah.
And we are
the Supernatural Junkies.
And we talk about all the things that you can't talk about in the church today.
And I like to talk about strengthening your faith, conspiracies, and how everything on TV is programming you. I like to talk about how our Bible is relevant, whether you're talking about artificial intelligence, so-called aliens, or secret societies. By the way, I know what Dr. Cruz likes to talk about as well.
Spoiler alert, I like to talk about how current events are prophetic and exactly what our Bibles warned us would happen. Alex, what's your jam?
I like to talk about ghosts, aliens, demon babies, supernatural healing, you name it. Be sure to check out our 100-plus episodes on places like Audible, iPodcast, iHeartRadio, and Spotify. Just search for the Supernatural Junkies wherever you podcast. Also, don't forget to like us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Kevin Cruz, and Alex is going to be joining us in a second. We are the Supernatural Junkies, and we have all the doctors in the house, and we have a very special guest today, Dr. Mark McDonald, and of course, a lot of people are familiar with him because he was on some pretty famous movies, and so he also wrote a book, and of course, it's about a lot of things, but it's called The United States of Fear, How America Fell Victim to a Mass Delusional Psychosis. He is author, and he is also a publisher of The Dissident MD. He graduated from UC Berkeley before attending medical school at Medical College of Wisconsin. He's been trained in both adult and child and adolescent psychiatry at UCLA, and he now primarily works with children in his private practice in Los Angeles. So welcome to the show, Dr. Mark, and we appreciate it. Dr. Dennis, I know you were formulating questions for this young man, so I'm going to let you go first.
Dr. Mark, before we started the podcast, I had asked you about if you had any of these patients in your office, and you gave us a little explanation of how you don't. But going from that, how do we help these parents dealing with these transgender children that are being brainwashed in the schools and so?
Unfortunately, by the time the contagion, and it is a social contagion, of transgenderism takes root, it's not a biological, medical, or even really emotional problem. It is purely a social contagion that can then morph into a mental illness, obviously, which is why it's so important to combat it. By the time it takes root, it's often very difficult, if not impossible, for the parents to eradicate it. So the best thing that the parent can do is to identify it early. And I would even say identify the possibility of the contagion early. What I mean by that is, if you haven't already, take your child out of a government or private school and homeschool your child. That's a preventive action. That's like putting a hat on and wearing long sleeve shirts when you go out into the sun. By the time you wait for the burn, there's really not much you can do to protect your skin. It's already occurred. Your child going day in and day out to a government or private school for 8 hours a day, plus lunchroom and post-school activities, most of which are done in secret. You don't even have the right to know about them. Many courts have decided against parental acknowledgement and informing of what happens at these transgendered clubs, already puts you behind, because now your influence is limited to a few minutes in the evening and on weekends versus 40 hours a week of indoctrination in school. That's vital. Take your kids out of government and private schools. Second, you must take away the smartphone from your child. If you have a child that's under age 18, that child should not have access to a smartphone at all, period. No exceptions. None. I used to be ambivalent about this. I used to say, well, under certain circumstances with parental controls and locks, it's useful, blah, 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 blah. It's not. There's no reason why a child should have a phone. I didn't grow up with a phone. I was fine. Flip phones is another story. You can text, you can call. You need it for emergencies, give your child a flip phone. No smartphones. Computers should only be accessed in a common room in the house. Children should not have computers in their bedrooms. Never. There's no reason for it. They should be in the kitchen or the living room. They should be tracked. You should tell your child, I'll give you access to the computer, but I will be looking at every single website you visited, and I guarantee that I'll check it every day. If you do that, you will already have eliminated about 80 to 90% of the possibility of the LGBTQ contagion from your child. I'm not talking about so much the gay and lesbian issue. That's a totally separate issue. I'm talking about transgenderism, which is really a mental illness. It's not a sexual preference idea. It's actually a psychological issue.
So, Doc, if I go backwards and, you know, you've been working with kids, and what are some of the kinds of kids that you've worked with in a general way over the last, let's say, since 2018?
So the biggest shift I've seen with children who I've seen from age 5 up to 18 in the last 5 to 10 years is a slowly and now more recently rapidly disappearing, weakening sense of identity. And I believe that, if you think of it like an immune system, an emotional immune system, has weakened children to be susceptible to this contagion of transgenderism. Because when a child grows up with a strong identity, a male or female, young girl, young boy identity, they're much less likely to be infected by this social contagion because they already know who they are. They don't need another identity. Now, it is normal and completely natural for young girls and young boys to go through a crisis of identity during puberty. And this is the reason why the number of transgendered girls in the pubertal phase has skyrocketed in the last 10 years. Historically, there's been a very, very small percentage of transgendered kids in the population. It's been fixed for the last 100, 200, 300 years. It suddenly exploded about 5-10 years ago. And interestingly, it exploded not in boys, but in girls. The percentage of boys that were transgendered was always far, far, far eclipsing the percentage of girls. Now it's reversed. Why is that? Did we suddenly have a genetic mutation among young girls to become transgendered? No, this is not biological. This is not genetic. This is environmental. It's 100% induced. And it's induced in girls largely because young girls suffer more from their identity crisis in puberty than boys do.
Right.
And today they don't know which way is up. They don't know how to express their femininity. They don't know how to look pretty, how to be alluring, how to attract young men, because they're told that they shouldn't. They're told that they should look like boys or at least look androgynous. And that doesn't make them happy. That doesn't make them feel valued. They're told, be strong, compete against boys, and get a job. That doesn't actually resonate with women in general. So these girls then move through their pubertal years wondering, well, who am I? Who am I supposed to become? And at school, they're identified by their teachers, their counselors, their friends as unhappy, as depressed, which they are, anxious, which they are. But rather than being referred for therapy for their anxiety and their depression and to understand how they're moving through their adolescence, they're told, you know what the problem is? The problem, Mary, is not that you're anxious or depressed. The problem is you're actually a boy. We have a club that will help you with that. It meets at lunch. Don't tell your parents because they won't support this. It's very important that you keep this a secret. And then that girl shows up at the club and there's all these other girls with short hair and jeans and t-shirts on that say, yeah, I'm a boy too. Are you a boy? Well, I don't know. Maybe. We think you are. And they develop an identity in this transgenderism cult that is inculcated on social media and in schools. And I've seen that as a huge shift in the last 10 years, not necessarily with the patients I see, but the precursor to it is present in the patients I see. The precursor is this floundering loss of support for the normal identity crisis of adolescents and young girls. And because we're not addressing that, we're actually making it worse. We're creating a problem in order to have a so-called solution. And the solution is to ultimately push girls into becoming what they think of as boys. Same thing that happened in 2020 medically. We created a problem which was making everybody sick and anxious and depressed and staying at home and wearing masks in order to have a solution, which was for everyone to get this so-called vaccine, which was going to free us from that horrible morass of being locked at home. But had we not done that, had we not locked our country down, we wouldn't have needed this solution. And this is a common recurring theme throughout human history among controlling fascist centralized power dictators. When there is a need to aggrandize more power, collect more money, take over a country, take over a people, you create a problem, you instigate a problem, and then you show up and you offer a solution to it. And everybody is so desperate for a solution to the problem that that just fell in their lap in the last 6 months that they're willing to do anything. And anything usually means giving up your liberty. And these poor girls, they're not only giving up their liberty, they're giving up their bodies, they're giving up their mental health, they're giving up their fertility, which can never be ever, ever returned to them. And a lifelong patient imprisonment of infections and hormonal adjustments and cancer and organ dysfunction, which of course benefits nobody except insurance companies, surgeons, pharmaceutical companies, because they make a fortune off of these young girls that have been sacrificed to their own cause, just like the so-called vaccine manufacturers did in 2021-23. And now they're doing with new drugs for fat people like Mounjaro, which is creating a problem, making people fat, and then later on giving them the solution, which is drugs. There was a study that just came out, a paper, a poster that was supported by the American Heart Association that went all over media that excoriated fasting, intermittent fasting, as leading to a 91% correlation with death from cardiovascular disease. 91% chance you die if you skip breakfast every day. Why would you do that? Why would you promote something like that? You promote it because fat people make money for the medical industry and the pharmaceutical industry. So I'm bringing in these examples that don't have anything to do with transgenderism to show that there's a bigger war going on. And transgenderism is just the most obvious battle in this war for independence versus control of our bodies and our minds.
Well, that was excellent.
So, Mark, the other thing I would say, it's funny you're bringing up the trauma side of this, that we have the pandemic itself being a trauma. But then what other traumas have you seen kids go through? Because a lot of times it's like, what was going on with them when they were having this identity crisis?
You know, I wrote in my book, United States of Fear, that you mentioned earlier, how the roots, the origins of this mass delusional psychosis began among the larger population. And it didn't start in 2020. It started decades earlier. It started with the loss of our freedoms, centralization of government, the rise of the entitlement narcissist culture of the hippies, which are now the baby boomers, which are leading the charge towards fascism. Ironically, the ones that were supposed to be anarchists are now in charge of pushing activist causes that remove our freedom for discourse, for civil rights, for First Amendment protections, for gun rights, all of that. What I've seen, seeing sort of the roots and the growth of this movement towards really a massive government state in the last 20 or 30 years, is that young people have been basically ideologically brainwashed to go against their natures of exploration, curiosity, social play, the healthy challenge of authority, and ultimately separation, individuation from their parents. We're seeing the opposite of all of those things happening now. Kids are only playing in isolated areas of their homes over headsets and Wi-Fi on either video games for boys or social media consoles for girls. They are not involved in sports, acting, music anymore. All that was taken away in 2020, and it's barely come back. The Cub Scouts and the Boy Scouts are gone. They've been forcibly disbanded because the Cub Scouts and the Boy Scouts wouldn't allow the girls to go into the boys and the boys to go into the girls, understandably so. The separation from the family has disappeared because now, more so than any previous generation, after high school, boys and girls both, especially boys who need the individuation far more than girls, are living with their parents. They started that in 2020 when they weren't allowed to go to college. They were supposed to do virtual university from their garage. Well, they're still doing it. They're still living at home and their parents are still taking care of them. Their parents are not kicking them out of the house. So the boys are not launching. They're not becoming men. There's also a complete breakdown, total complete breakdown in the social integration of boys and girls as they become young men and young women. Young boys, teenagers, in my practice, they are scared to death of asking a girl out, much less even saying that she's attractive or you look nice today, lest they be accused of misogyny or patriarchy or, God forbid, even assault in some cases, because words are violence, right? That's what we're told now. Speech is hate, and hate, of course, is criminal. I have one patient in my practice who was charged falsely with rape while he was at graduate school. I had seen him for 10 years as a teenager, a few years ago in Michigan at business school. His whole life has been ruined. He doesn't even want to leave his parents' home now, even though he won the case and the girl was mentally ill, actually, because he's scared to death that this is going to happen to him again. And if it does, he'll lose his job, his career. He'll be ostracized from the local community here in Los Angeles. When people Google his name, the first thing that pops up is accused of rape, comma, first name, last name in Michigan has been blah, blah. And as soon as you see rape and your name, it's all over. So there has been, I think, an attack on normal, healthy development in children at every level for the last 5 to 10 years, certainly in the last 4 to 5 years, that has led these poor young children to be emotionally unwell, psychologically confused, physically out of shape, socially autistic, and professionally way out of their league in being able to even hold down a job because they don't even know what a work ethic is anymore. I think we're looking at a massive disaster that's going to be crashing on our shores in the next 5 to 10 years. We're already seeing it washing up right now. If you ask people about hiring practices, no one wants to hire young people because they can't trust them. They can't count on them. It's going to get far worse before it gets better unless we, the adults, take charge and start bringing our children back under our wings and not allowing them to be informed and brainwashed and controlled by social media, by government, and by schools.
I think that's an excellent detailed answer because what you're seeing, we're seeing the consequences of the destruction of the family over the last 40 years. And now they're so vulnerable that they do not, you know, the kids don't go out to play. I remember when I was a child, I mean, I couldn't get off the ball field. I mean, I didn't come home until my mom rang the bell, the dinner bell, you know. And now these kids, they don't go out. They're on their phones. They're staring at these phones. They can't have conversations. And you see the attack on the human race is basically what we're seeing.
You're correct. This is at its fundamental root cause. And this is what unifies all people, whether they're atheist, religious, Jews, Christians, gay, straight, rich, poor. What is unifying in everything I just talked about is that there is an attack on life itself. It is a satanic. I can't fully give an answer or a rationale for all of this that is in the physical realm. There has to be some satanic evil element involved that is so piercing and so focused on the attack against life. And the core element, the core unit, human created unit, not life, which is created by God, but the human unit that's created by humans that promotes life is the family. If you can destroy the family, you will destroy life. And every single thing that we have been seeing in the last 20, 30, 40 years, the last 4 years is huge, that is disturbing and unwell and destructive, all targets the family. Because if you can wipe the family out, then everything else falls. That's why I think the family is under such attack. And that's why I think the transgender movement is so dangerous and also so well-funded. Because transgenderism at its core, it's not just an attack on girls and boys, it's an attack on the family. Because you cannot have a family if you're transgendered. If you infertilize yourself, if you make it impossible to reproduce, then you won't have children. So you end humanity. The human race ultimately ends if transgenderism succeeds. That is about the most bleak pronouncement I can imagine for any cause. It's like in the 1980s, the threat of massive thermonuclear war. That's what we're looking at with transgenderism. And not a shot being fired.
Yeah, well, they took over the world in 2020 without firing a shot, too. You know, I mean, and you, like you said, it's problem, action, solution. And that's their modus operandi.
It is.
So, doctor, you know, go ahead, Dr. Bozier.
You would look at this and you said a certain word and that opened the door, meaning to shoot on in here. When you mentioned it was satanic and we look at that, that's adversarial, of course. If you would look at this and I've been looking at it this way for some time because it's true. What you're seeing is what you're seeing today is everything that is antithetical to what God placed in order. Okay. For example, God said male, female. And so what you see here is a perversion of this. Now, you went to the family as well. And I'm going to ask a question from what I'm saying. You went to the family and the need for the family to once again take charge of the raising of their children. And I'm saying take charge because a lot of families did neglect this. They let it go and they depended on the government. They depended on the school. They depended on teachers to bring their children out. Now, through counseling, as I'm sure you're aware of, there's a term that is known as desensitization or systematic desensitization. And usually we want to use that in a good sense. Like if a person has been introduced to an environment that can be damaging to them, you gradually introduce it to them until this no longer affects them. Does it seem to be like a reversal of that? And what we see where individuals are being desensitized from what they were made to be and getting to believe that there's something else. And they may have been going through some problems because they were having this identity crisis. For example, girls being tomboys or whatever, and they seem to not fit. And people may have made fun of them. And then we have an education system and other people who are speaking to our children and saying, no, there's not a problem. This is what the issue is. You're not embracing who you really are. And the person struggles with that for a while, but they hear it more and more and more. And then they're introduced to an environment, their environmental structure is conducive to this. And then soon they're no longer sensitive to what they really are. They've been desensitized and now they begin to believe that they're something else. Could we be seeing something that I know that's usually not used that way, but could we be seeing that sort of like in a reversal?
I think that there is more of a displacement of the problem than a desensitization or reverse desensitization that's occurring, because human beings will always struggle. And it's identifying the struggles honestly and facing them honestly that allows one to grow and develop. Due to a combination of affluence, narcissism, and entitlement that have been labeled as virtuous starting in 2020, infused with what I would call the victim culture, we've now developed a renorming of society where acknowledging and facing real struggles is no longer considered to be virtuous. In fact, doing the opposite is disavowing your struggle, displacing it into something else that's fictional, and then fighting it by attacking other people who are doing good and claiming victimhood status is now considered to be virtuous. I know for a fact, because I just spoke to a university student back east who dropped out of a graduate school program in English after she couldn't handle the wokeism in the department, that the actual papers, the academic papers that are being written and taught and assign to the students in the English departments around the United States, identify, and I'm not paraphrasing, this is the exact words that they use. They advocate for victimhood as identity. Specifically, this one paper I just read today referred to Blacks, Black Americans, as unbelievably not free until they accept lifelong victimhood. So they perverted the word with freedom to make it an enslavement. They've inverted the actual struggle for equality and said the only way to be equal is to accept that you're unequal and play the victim role for the rest of your life. Now, this article was about Blacks, but you could substitute any so-called aggrieved group in the United States. It could be gay, it could be women, it could be Christians, it could be white people. Doesn't matter, whatever it is. Any aggrieved group should take on an identity, not just like an event, like I was victimized by a car hitting my home yesterday, but today I'm starting to repair the house. No, this is an identity that you take on. They use the word philosophy and ideology, that we should all become permanent, chronic victims in order to be free and in order to feel good about ourselves. This is the inversion of good psychological health. And this is what's being taught to young people. It's what's being taught to university students. It's what's being taught to employees. It's what's being taught to us as citizens by the government. This, I think, is the confluence of a lot of bad things that have been brewing in the last few decades and in the last 4 or 5 years. And attacking it and criticizing it is very difficult, because the moment that you do that, you are put outside and you are being seen as an aggressor, as a misogynist, as a racist, as a transphobe. Fill in the phobe and you've got it, Islamophobic, etc. Until we are able to identify this and speak to it truthfully, call it out for what it is, make it evil. Tucker Carlson says this a lot. He says, we need to call out evil for evil. We need to make judgments. We need to criticize. We don't need what many people in what I would call the naive, well-intentioned, weak, traditional liberal Democrat voter often do, which is calling for more conversation, not judging, hearing all sides, being sensitive, being forgiving, because this actually invites more of what I just described. I think that one of the core goals of collectivism and leftism and Satanism is to erase distinctions, is to make it impossible to issue a judgment. Just as the recent proclamation by the Pope, who is ostensibly representing the Catholic Church, said, I wish and I hope that no souls are in hell. Why did he say that? He said that because if there were souls in hell, that would mean that they were judged. And if you judge, that means that you state what is good and what is evil. And our Pope, our Catholic Pope, is a leftist. He's a collectivist. He's a communist. He's maybe not a bad person in his intentions, but he does bad things, because it doesn't matter what your intention is. What matters is what you do in your actions. And his intention is to make people feel good, to not be judged, to not tell the child who has spilled the milk, who has beaten the cat, who has not done his homework, that he's bad. No, we need to have more conversations. We can't judge. We just have to do timeouts. No, we have to say, when you spill the milk, you have to clean it up. You're not allowed to hurt animals. If you don't turn in your homework, you get an F and you lose your dinner and you don't get your allowance. But these are judgments. And a lot of people who are otherwise well-intentioned today, good people that want to do right, they don't want to judge. And we need to do more judging. We need to do more distinctions, more delineations of right and wrong, good and evil. And that is exactly the opposite of what the left wants. The left wants no judgment. The left wants impassioned attack. They want Trump derangement syndrome to continue. They want people to foam at the mouth and go and, like zombies and hordes, go and mob people and toss them out of stores because they don't want to wear masks. But that's not really judgment. That's just mob mentality. Judgment is about delivering a decision with empathy, but a decision that's dispassionate, that's not driven by emotion, but driven by values. This is what I think is going on in the bigger picture on a philosophical and a spiritual level.
So, Mark, I was going to ask you, you said there's a difference between the LG and then the BTQ. And I know a lot of people, we've talked about that, but tell us what you mean by that.
It's really important to distinguish transgenderism from everything else. I don't know why the lesbian and gay activist community allowed the transgender letter to be attached to their moniker, their acronym, because they have nothing to do with one another. In fact, I would say that gays and lesbians are, they have the most to lose from the transgender movement. Lesbian women, for example, lesbian girls, they want protection from male predators. And most of the transgendered men, for example, in prisons or in sports competitions, prey on women. They victimize women. Most transgendered adult men are not even sexually confused. Most of them are heterosexual. They just want access to women in a way that wasn't afforded to them legally or socially, in locker rooms, in bathrooms, in prisons, in sports competitions. Why on earth any lesbian woman would support the transgender community is beyond me. I think that to distinguish between transgenderism, which is a mental illness, and gay and lesbianism, which is a sexual preference or a sexual orientation, is paramount, because gays and lesbians don't have a predilection for preying on children or raping people, but transgenders do, especially transgendered men. And I think it's a defamation of character to make the assumption that gays and lesbians would support transgender rights, so to speak, which means being able to have access to, from the point of view of men, very vulnerable young girls and women, because that implies that somehow, as had been implied 40 or 50 years ago, that gay men like to molest boys, or that lesbian women are somehow trying to coerce and blackmail young girls into becoming gay. And this was all disproven over, it was a calumny, really, against gays and lesbians. And I think that the rise of groups like Gays Against Groomers is an excellent sign that gays, that's gay men and gay women, are finally starting to realize that their struggle for equal legal rights and to be left alone, essentially, is being hijacked on the part of pedophilia performing men and confused and victimized young adolescent girls in order to take advantage of people who are actually vulnerable. And this is wrong. This is evil. And that's why I think the transgender issue unifies everyone, even gays and lesbians, because even they have something to lose by the takeover of their movement from the transgender right.
Well, we're starting to see conservative gays actually talk about the separation from the transgender, because the message of the transgender is that you can't have a sexual preference, right? Because that's some sort of ism, right? You're transphobic against them if you have, in fact, a sexual preference. And you're like, that's completely opposite the gay and lesbians, which is clearly a sexual preference. So it's right. Wild that this is happening, but you do see some movement toward that separation now. And I think as it continues to go further and further into madness, I'm pretty sure they will split, I hope, you know, because that's just pure insanity at that point.
Now, I heard you say that, I want to make sure I heard you right, and I'm kind of like, the semantics are going to be a little different, but I heard you say that gay men or homosexual men, I'm speaking to Dr. McMahon right now, you said that gay men, I believe you said, not predatorial towards boys or something like that, or something of that nature. Okay. If they're gay men, their preference is going to be other males. So what is your take on how they go about this?
Well, what I meant by that very specifically is that gay men are not a priori more likely to be child molesters than straight men. Obviously, they're attracted to men, so they're more likely to have sex with other men than heterosexual men are, who have virtually no predilection for sexual activity with men, unlike women, who tend to be more, and this is actually true, sexually fluid, meaning most women are capable of having sexual relationships with men or women, most heterosexual women. They make the choice to be with men, but they often, most women, most adult women, have had some either sexual fantasies or sexual experiences with other women, even though they don't consider themselves gay. That is very rare for a heterosexual man. Male sexuality appears to be really hardwired. Female sexuality is not. But the point that I made about the pedophilia is that there is a very high incidence of self-defined and self-described transgender men engaging in sex with children, especially children of the same sex. And for gay men to support transgendered men's access to public areas like locker rooms and bathrooms and places in sports teams where young people are likely to be present and vulnerable is unbelievable, because that simply reinforces the long-held, widely held belief that gay men are likely to have sex with young children, which I don't believe has been shown to be true. And that's why I think it's so important to separate these out and to look at this as a from a position of values. The fact that one is gay doesn't indicate that that person wants to vote for Democrats, for example. There's a lot of conservative gay men and conservative gay women, because sexual preference doesn't determine your values. There's a lot of gays in the church, a lot of religious people. Sexual preference has nothing to do with politics. So why on earth would a politically charged issue like transgenderism be attached to gay and lesbianism? Because I have not yet met a single active transgendered individual who is a vocal conservative, because they are intricately tied together. And that's why I don't believe it's biological. Sexuality is largely biological. Transgenderism has nothing to do with biology. It's a mental illness. Yeah. And years ago, we used to call homosexuality a mental illness. The DSM-4, the Psychological Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, removed that decades ago in order to reduce or remove the stigma of homosexuality from mental illness and put it into more of a biological category. Well, if we start to put transgenderism into a biological category, we're doomed. We have to keep it as it is, which is a social contagion that manifests as a mental illness. And that is distinct from sexual preference.
Now, that placing that in a category, because I'm familiar, they changed it from a disorder to really what it is ended up being, with the people who felt it was wrong, they had the disorder, homophobia. So another one of those phobias coming up. So that's in the world of science. But when if we just look at it as science and say, okay, it's all acceptable. Now I'm going to come from a biblical aspect. Are we helping them any as far as their walk with God? Because I heard you say Christians who are, there can be people who profess to be, but as true Christians, we have to line up with the word and will of God. And so there will be, if a person is born again and they have the Spirit of God, would there not be a desire to change and be set free from whatever this is? Man can change it and say so because it fits man. We can say mores or whatever, but God remains the same forever. So how do we look at that?
Well, that's a religious and spiritual question that I'm not an expert at and wouldn't want to speak on.
Okay.
My personal opinion is that, and my understanding is that in most churches, the goal is not to take away or eliminate or reverse sexual preference, but to encourage the individual to restrict the acting on or the behaving on of that sexual preference. Because it's very difficult, particularly with men, to reverse a preference for men to a preference for women, unless someone's bisexual, in which case it really is a, by definition, it's a choice, isn't it, who you sleep with? But for most gay men, I don't believe that it's a choice for them to be gay. It's a lot easier to be not gay, actually. Being gay is actually makes your life a lot harder if you're a man. For a woman, it might be a little different. But for men, it's definitely not a choice most people would make. On the other hand, transgenderism really isn't about behavior, is it? It's really about your so-called identity. And the only way for you to manifest that identity is to go out into society dressed as and acting as someone of the opposite sex, which immediately changes the social mores, as you said, or the social milieu. One can be homosexual and be completely unassuming. You don't have to dress differently. You don't have to have a gay accent. You don't have to make out with people in public. You can basically live the life of a straight man as a gay man and no one really is the wiser. And why should they? You know, what you do as a sexual being, certainly outside of a church setting, in a social setting, is really no one's business. At a church, obviously, there's other issues involved, understandably. But with transgenderism, I don't think you can do that. How can you live a hidden life of a transgender without, by definition, going out and expressing yourself as the opposite sex? And now you're presenting that to the public and to children, and you're having an effect on society. And that's why I think it's problematic.
Well, and there is a spiritual, non-material assumption that, you know, somehow I was born in the wrong body. But, you know, I want you to get to some of these action plans. So to me, you know, if I'm born in the wrong body, you know, they're going to put me on these chemical castration drugs. They're going to mutilate my body. Can you describe some of what that really means as far as the drugs and the surgeries?
So you've just brought up a really important point, Kevin. I think this is a critical aspect of the transgender debate that everyone must understand, either the parents, the teachers, the pastors, everyone. And that is the following. Transgenderism is not a biological, medical, or physical illness. For example, as is having six toes, where the treatment for that, if you wish to undergo treatment, is to have one of the toes amputated. And now you have five toes, and now you're normal. If we had somebody, and we still do today, although it's less common, come to a therapist's office and say, I think my nose is a foot long, and my waist is 35 inches around, even though I measure my nose as 2 inches and my waist is 24 inches. Therefore, I want to have half my nose cut off and I want to have 40% of the fat in my abdomen taken out. The therapist or the doctor ethically must say, no, your nose is 2 inches, your waist is 24. You have what's called body dysmorphic disorder. That is an emotional or psychological illness. The treatment involves therapy and perhaps medication, psychiatric medication. That is the treatment I will offer you because you don't have a biological problem. What we have done now, which is anathema to medicine, first do no harm, and then, of course, tell the truth, is we have allowed for the diagnosis of transgenderism to shift from a mental illness to a medical biological condition. And once you do that, it opens the door for medical and biological treatments, which, as you described, involve surgeries and mutilations of the breasts, the genitals, as well as treatments to remove certain facial features and bone changes in the bone structure, and the castration and freezing of puberty by puberty blockers in either pre-pubertal boys and girls or post-pubertal young men and women, all of which cause irreversible damage to the body, infertility, cancer, chronic infections, none of which can be easily reversed, if reversed at all. All of which would be considered grounds for a malpractice lawsuit, a civil massive lawsuit, if a doctor were to do that to someone like I just described, who thought her nose were too big or her waist were too large. We are obligated to approach this in the exact same way. The fact that we are not is illegal and it's unethical and it's immoral. I know many people who I have spoken with and who I have read about who are now permanently disabled because they have undergone surgeries or had their puberty blocked for a number of years and who no longer can have children, who can no longer breastfeed a baby, impregnate a woman, live for more than a week at a time without taking another antibiotic treatment due to ongoing open wounds, urinate properly, defecate properly, none of which will ever be resolved. These are people who are either happy or not happy with their so-called transition. It doesn't matter. But many of them are unhappy, and they are unable to receive medical attention and support to reverse these so-called gender-affirming care procedures because insurance companies are only offering and only obligated to offer the gender transitioning procedures, but not the return to normal or detransitioning procedures. This is horrible. And I think one action step that can be taken to reverse this horrific abuse of authority in medicine is to order, by law, all insurance companies to offer on an equal basis gender re or detransitioning treatments and surgeries, just as they offer the transitioning ones. And this would be a financial incentive in order to avoid bankruptcy that would force all of these insurance companies to stop willy-nilly throwing out the coverage to have these puberty blockers and these mutilation surgeries performed as if they can somehow be changed and reversed a year later, which of course we all know they can't be. That's a practical legislative step that can be taken to stop this in the medical arena from expanding. And it expands every day because another state passes a law requiring insurance companies to cover these procedures, whether you're private or public, to have them offered to jailed inmates, for example, to offer them to Medi-Cal, to poor people. Pretty soon it'll be Medicare. All of our tax dollars are going into these surgeries under the guise of equal protection. Well, it's not equal protection for children or for adults. And if we want to make it equal, we're going to have to offer the same thing in the opposite direction, and that'll put an end to it.
Those are good points, Doctor. But you're saying this, and I'm thinking from, you know, a standpoint of being a physician myself and what we have to deal with, you know, there should be some policing of the professions within themselves. And I don't know why or how the AMA has allowed this or how other doctors, why other doctors are not speaking out against this. It is mutilation. You know, I mean, you look at certain medical procedures where you have neonatal care and they'll spend millions of dollars on saving a child's life. And then on the other end, they're aborting 4,000 children a day. And you really question the motives behind medicine. I'm sorry. I mean, there's no other way, you know, to say it. I understand your point about, you know, having this, the insurance company to cover the other side of it. And I agree with you. But I don't think they should cover any of it. I don't know how they you know, everything we do is always evidence-based and medically necessary. So how is this evidence-based and medically necessary, given with all the facts you have just put through, you know, today during this interview? I mean, everything you said, it could be used as a testimony to get away from these surgeries.
Well, you're correct. And this is why I often argue that those who are opposed to transgender pediatric medical treatments are missing the point because they think it's about consent. Well, children can't consent to this, so they shouldn't be under the knife and have their puberty blocked. Well, of course, that's true. But it's more than just a consent issue. As you pointed out correctly, doctors face an ethical obligation to first do no harm. There is no argument, none, no objective, moral, or ethical argument to support any of these mutilation procedures or, in the case of postpubertal adults, hormone-blocking agents. Absolutely none. They don't do any good. The only research that we have, and there's very little research actually, the strongest coming out of Denmark, which are longitudinal studies, shows overwhelmingly that any adult, not child, I'm not talking about children now, adults, who undergo these procedures have a higher rate of dissatisfaction, depression, and actual suicide. Contrary to what you hear in the media that these procedures save lives, they don't. They endanger lives. Mm-hmm. They actually have a higher rate of medical complications, unwellness psychologically, and suicide. These procedures, which are meant to treat gender dysphoria, are the wrong approach because the gender dysphoria, as I said, is not a biological or medical problem.
Right.
So, cutting off body parts doesn't actually solve the problem. It creates new ones. The real problem, which is, again, as I said earlier, we're displacing all of our issues into other zones. The real problem is psychological. Therefore, children with so-called gender dysphoria should be treated psychologically. They should be treated with therapy. They should not be treated with medications or surgery. And no adult should be allowed to undergo this procedure either, in the same way that a plastic surgeon would not amputate a limb in a 20, 60, or 80-year-old person who comes in and says, I identify as a one-armed man, so cut my arm off. Any surgeon that did that would be put in jail,
yep,
put in prison, lose his license. Why? Because this is not a biological problem. This is a psychological one. Cutting off an arm does not solve that. So therefore, I think if you want to be consistent, in the same way that one is consistent about abortion, if abortion is wrong, and if it's a baby after conception, whether you kill that baby at week 1, 10, 20, 40, or after birth makes no difference. It's still a death, right?
Correct.
In the same way, we need to be consistent in our arguments, morally and ethically and intellectually and evidence-based arguments that none of this so-called gender-affirming care at any age is either medical, legal, or moral. None. Zero. It should be banned completely. And the reason why it hasn't happened is that, as you pointed out, all of the medical organizations that manage licensing and that organize board certifications and set community standards are corrupt. The AMA 4 years ago announced that it would support the removal of M and F on birth certificates in place of X, meaning no sex. That's the AMA's public policy position. It's not one crazy board member on the edge of the fringe. This is their formal policy. Mm-hmm. The AACAP, American Academy of Children and Pediatrics, Medicine, Psychiatry, their formal position is to support hormone blockers and puberty blockers in children. This is the Board of Psychiatry for Children that is affirming this. The American Academy of Pediatrics, also on board with puberty blockers in children. All three of the major organizations, the AMA, the psychiatric pediatric community, and the pediatrician organizations, they're all in favor of this stuff. So if we can't find support from them, I mean, even rationality, much less support, there's no reason to take anything that they say seriously, to allow them to speak on our behalf, or to use them as substantive evidence to support any of these treatments. They need to be expulsed. They need to be completely ignored. They need to be criticized. They have, in my eyes, entirely lost their authority in the same way that, you know, a pastor that would advocate for suicide and abortion and pedophilia should be expulsed from his church. Well, these people should be expulsed from the community of medicine. They're abhorrent, they're doing damage, and they don't represent any physician that has a moral position on this whatsoever.
Amen. Amen to that.
It feels like a lot of these protocols and treatments, especially the surgery itself, seems exploitive and experimental, because, you know, you hear so many about, well, more than one out of two, it goes wrong, you know? So I don't know how we've gotten this far with it when it's a little bit like the Wild West with the surgeries, isn't it?
Well, follow the money. There's a multi-pronged effort to push this ball over the finish line with transgenderism. And part of it is satanic and evil. Part of it is political. And part of it is financial. And the financial aspect is probably the one that's the most easily attacked. And that is that the amount of money that's being funneled into these clinics, into these therapy groups, into these surgical suites is in the billions of dollars now. And it's mostly coming from state and federal government by misappropriation of tax dollars, and also co-opting and coercing and blackmailing by putting really a kind of figurative gun to the head of all the private insurance companies to force all of the single payers to pay for these medications and these surgeries, not just once, but for the life of the patient, to create a lifelong patient. Kaiser, as you probably know, is being sued by multiple people. Including one young girl, Chloe Cole, who had her breast cut off when she was, I think, 14 or 15 years old. And she's now suing them, good for her, after having received absolutely no therapy, no second opinion. I think she spent 8 or 9 minutes at Kaiser saying, I think I'm a boy. And then they just put her under the knife. And they made, you know, $50, $60, $80, $100,000 on the surgeries. And now they're making money just by providing this so-called maintenance treatment. She can't get treatment to reverse it because they don't offer that. So I think one of the most effective points of attack on this economic angle is to put into place lawsuits, just like Chloe Cole is doing, to bankrupt any individual clinic or institution that sponsors and supports these treatments for children or for adults. The first time that we see a multi-million dollar lawsuit won against some place like, say, Kaiser, that will be the end of this. Because no hospital, no clinic, no Boston University Children's Clinic, no Yale Child Study Center that's raking in millions of dollars right now, sacrificing children, just like Planned Parenthood is with their abortion clinics, is going to continue to support this if their CEO sees the bottom line as being a red one rather than a black one. They want to be in the black, not in the red. Now, this is callous, of course, on their part. They're sacrificing lives for money. But that's the way that you fight people like that, is you take their money away. You threaten them with bankruptcy. If there's no source, There's no clinic. There's no surgical suite. There's no center sponsored, you know, under the Harvard banner that sort of gives this impregnature of morality and academic worthiness. What's really just a mutilation clinic. If we lose that, if that's all taken away, who's going to perform these? You can't do back alley breast surgeries. They have to be done in an academic center or at a big organization like Kaiser. So sue them into oblivion, scare them into putting a stop to this, and then this will stop. I think that's another action point that's very important in the legislative arena because it overlaps with economics and finance. There's millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars really at stake here. And if we attack that, then I think we win in the area of the institutional and organizational level.
I think another good thing that we have for us, and I just looked it up just to double check, but that just this month, the UK banned prescribing the puberty blockers starting April 1st. So there's you have that's their National Health Service, and they're no longer going to routinely prescribe these medications, which, you know, is another voice from outside the U.S. that can help us.
We are behind. It's interesting how the environmental activist fringe has taken off in Europe far faster than they have in the U.S. But one thing that Europe and in England have ahead of us is their pushback against this advancement into the transgender surgery and puberty blockers movement. It's disappearing. After the closure of the Tavistock Clinic last year in London, after massive class action lawsuits by hundreds and hundreds of young children and now young adults who had been mutilated, the government shut it down. And then, as you just noted, the process for a national ban on all of these treatments that expanded away from the Tavistock just to the National Health Institute, Health Center in England, is now laying down the law, literally laying down the law and saying it's not legal anymore to do this. What's fascinating and sort of perplexing is that despite all of these legal actions being taken across Europe, we are not following suit. You know, the Biden administration often points to Europe as being ahead of us in environment and removing internal combustion cars and forcing windmills on us. And we need to follow their lead because we need to be at the forefront. But isn't it interesting how they're eerily silent when it comes to being at the forefront of reversing the transgender care, so-called care movement, which is Europe is way ahead of us. So I think that there's intention behind the silence and intention behind the lack of widespread dissemination of the news that you just cited, because you don't see it in the New York Times or in CNN. You see it only in small social media and some of the non-legacy news organizations, because if word got out that the rest of the world is turning their back on this, there might be more fissures and cracks in the U.S. that expand to push back against it like there has in Europe.
I agree. I think, and also you can always go by the old adage, follow the money.
Absolutely.
We know where the money is. And like we said before, the controversial stances that medicine has made, you know, saving babies and killing babies in the same breath, you know, and it's ridiculous. Dr. D, do you have any questions?
No, I'm depleted of questions.
Well, I'm gonna. So you
D
guys
for depletion.
You guys were talking about a little bit of some of the subjects of the book, but you mentioned cognitive dissonance, and this is something I think that we like to talk about because it's funny, people don't see that the very thing they're supporting, you know, they're not applying to other clear examples right in front of them. And so I know you wrote the book, obviously, you know, and the idea is the United States of Fear, how they use fear and then created this mass delusional psychosis. I know this is one of Dr. Dozier's favorite subjects. So explain what you mean by that. Why did you write that book?
I first wrote the book in 2021, early part of that year, to explain to people who were completely confused how we came to this state of everyone in the United States losing their mind at the same time.
Interesting.
And from one day to the next, people were wearing masks while running outside. Where did this come from? How does this happen? It's not just one crazy wacko. This was happening in hundreds of millions of people all over the country, all of a sudden. And a lot of people couldn't explain it. So I wrote the book to explain the antecedents to that. How it started in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, all these various movements. The feminist movement plays a part in this, attacking masculinity and extolling the virtues of femininity without attacking equally the failings of femininity. Both sexes have their weaknesses, laying the ground for the disappearance of the courageous man and the emergence of the coward. I remember seeing a family walking outside through the botanical garden at UCLA early on during this pandemic, and the wife, I assume it was the wife, walking ahead of the two daughters, all of whom are wearing masks, guiding the way, while the man, I assume was the husband, walking behind, sort of half beaten down, his head weary, hanging over with the mask on his face, with this look in his eyes like, I know this is ridiculous and insane, but I dare not speak because if I do, my wife will beat me up, metaphorically speaking. He had no balls, basically. And I saw this all over the United States, women losing themselves emotionally, impassioned, which is understandable. Women are more emotional creatures. But the men not standing up and saying, whoa, 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 back off. I've got this. We're going to be okay. I run the family now. We're in a crisis. Take care of the kids. I'll deal with this. No, they let the woman run wild. They let her toxic femininity out of the box. That happened decades ago. That just didn't happen in 2020. This was one aspect of many, many, many cultural changes that have been going under the radar that just exploded in 2020. Another, of course, is social media, the control of manipulation of information, the centralization of power in the government, the disappearance of the family in being able to monitor what's happening in the school system. All of these things, they all just poof, they all took off once the government, media, and corporations all came together and said, we're going to do this. We're going to take over and no one's going to stop us. I wrote that book to explain that process. And after I wrote it, people started coming up to me and saying, but what do we do now? And that's why I wrote a second book the following year called Freedom from Fear, a 12-step guide to personal and national recovery. And this is modeled after Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life and the AA model or the 12-step model of addiction, because I do believe that once this delusional psychosis became manifest, it evolved into what I call a fear addiction, where people just instinctively reach for a mask, even if they're not afraid. Like they reach for a cigarette when they're nervous. Now they reach for a mask. I don't even think it's conscious anymore. So I started to say, this is the way I want to see it now. It's not so much a delusional psychosis anymore medically. It's more like a fear addiction. And the way that you treat an addiction, as we all know, is the first step is to acknowledge that you have an addiction. That's what they do in AA. And I went through 12 steps from 1 to 12, starting with acknowledging that you have an addiction, and 12 to becoming a mentor for others once you're free from your fear and everything in between, to teach people, the individual, this book is towards the individual, it's not meant for the society at large, to the individual who has perhaps friends or family who are also addicted, to explain to them how to go by step overcoming this fear addiction. How do you fight a beast as large as mass delusional psychosis? Well, you don't. You attack it at the individual level. Instead of trying to transform society, waiting for the great messiah to come down and take over the White House, which didn't work, we need to go about this from a ground-up approach. We need to attack this on an individual level. Free your husband, your wife, your children, your neighbor first from fear addiction with freedom from fear. Reorganize your community to be a community of strength and fearlessness and promoting courage. And then from there, take on the school boards, take on the county government system, the state government. Go from the bottom up. Virginia showed us that election success a few years ago, when all the people came together, both Democrats and Republicans, and they voted out the left-wing school board, and they said, we're done. They took over. They didn't go to Washington. They went to their town hall forum. Mothers, fathers going to the school board meetings, speaking out against what's happening to children, pornography in the schools. This is, I think, how we overcome our mass delusional psychosis. We free ourselves and our friends and our loved ones from fear, and we proselytize that freedom from fear to everyone around us. And once we do that, we go up, 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 and eventually we get to the top of the country. I think we made a huge mistake 4 years ago in trying to go top down. I think we have to go bottom up. I firmly believe that. I believe that more and more every single day.
That's a great answer, Doctor. I mean, I think fear will hold people captive, and it has. And we saw that culmination of that fear in the COVID crisis.
and it's just perpetuated since. And now, but when you were talking about that picture of that man walking behind his family and so forth, and there's also some, you know, some science behind that too. I think that, you know, through the food supply and all the estrogens in the food and the low testosterone, that, you know, men are having, you know, they have lower T, they also have lower sperm counts and all these other things. We've been under attack for years, and right now at this point, we do need to stand up and fight back.
Men have become biologically and socially feminized
Yes.
over the last four decades. And there's Yes. evidence for this, as you said, lower sperm count, lower fertility rates, lower muscle mass, as well as socially, men not exercising their role as containers of hyper-emotionality, particularly among women. And I don't mean controlling and aggressing and abusing. I mean containing. Men's role is to contain. Women's role is to receive and is to nurture. And this is what makes men feel valuable and wanted and desired. This is what makes women feel useful and attractive and desired. And both sexes have walked away from that. And we need to return to that model of real masculinity, physical courage, strength, honor, virtue. We don't have that anymore. We have the opposite. We have conciliation. We have diplomacy. We have compromise. We have lack of physical strength. We have saying nothing and doing nothing in the face of risk and violence on the part of other aggressors, of not speaking up to women when they step out of fear that they're going to be accused of misogyny and they're going to lose their job. And this just inculcates and exaggerates and exacerbates all of the worst aspects of the feminine, because there's good and bad in the feminine, just as there is of the masculine. Men are, and appropriately so, told to control their sexual aggression and their physical violence. That is a masculine trait. And if they cross that line, they are appropriately called out, as they should be. But what about the cattiness of women, the borderline personality stabbing in the back attacks that girls do by publishing nasty pictures online of their friends and calling them out as fat and ruining their lives, pushing girls to suicide? We don't do anything about that. And this has to be, men, fathers have to stand up. Where are the fathers at these games, these football games, when a 6'2", 200 hulking pound guy comes in wearing a dress and goes and beats up on his daughter and puts her in a coma on the football field or the soccer field? Mm-hmm. Where are the dads? The mothers are crying into their napkins, and the men are just like looking around saying, well, I don't want to be called transphobic. They should go out and pick up that boy and toss him over the fence. And if that Absolutely. Happened, that would end. No more boys in skirts going out on the fields. Where are these men? Because they have all become cowards. They're all eunuchs. We need to bring back masculinity. And that's not just for the sake of men. It's for the sake of women and for their daughters, too.
Well, it's a good point. And I think Dr. Dozer could speak to this better than I can. But so I think a lot of that has to do with the spiritual aspect, and that the fact that without the spirituality, a man is not going to be a man. And I think it's an inside out job.
So, guys, last question for Alex here, and go ahead, man.
Yeah, we're almost done. So as a final question, what can parents do to stop their children from being put on transition drugs or gender-affirming meds?
This is a really, really difficult situation, because parents are in a very legally weak position in a lot of states. And fathers, and it's unfortunately, it seems to be relatively few, but the ones that do stand up to this tend to be mostly fathers and men. Women are disproportionately in charge of destroying and responsible for destroying the lives of our children, which is a horrible thing that I to even have to say it, but it's true. And I always speak the truth, even if it makes people uncomfortable. It's mothers, it's teachers, it's therapists, it's surgeons, it's librarians, it's nurses, most of whom are women who are pushing this. It's not, largely speaking, men. Unfortunately, the courts are aligned against men, and they are aligned for women, and they are aligned against children. They are aligned towards removing the rights of parents trying to protect their kids from this transgender ideology, whether male or female,
yeah,
whether mothers or fathers. And if it's happening, if you see it moving forward, there's often very little you can do other than physically relocate yourself to a more protective state or a more protective county. because you will have your child physically removed from you. You will be banned from being able to see your child. You will have your child put into social services if you don't affirm the name, affirm the dress, affirm the lifestyle. It's very, very scary right now. And that's why I think the preemptive strike is the best one. Take your kids out of school, homeschool them. Remove the cell phones. Make sure you know who your kids are playing with, what parents and other children they're associating with. Form groups of like-minded people. The like-minded are stronger than one sole person living in a silo. You can't live that way forever. Your kids are going to grow up. They're going to get older. They're going to get independent. You have to protect them within that community, knowing that they're still going to get exposed, but at least you can limit the exposure. If, in fact, your child is already exposed and is already secretly going through a transition or looking for drugs, looking for surgery, you're behind the eight ball. It's going to be very difficult for you to succeed because the moment you stand up and fight, the system is going to fight twice as hard against you. The therapists, the teachers, the doctors, all the people that are involved are going to start filing lawsuits against you, and you may end up losing your child. Your only option may be what a family in Oregon did a couple of years ago, an Indian immigrant family that noticed that their 14-year-old daughter was secretly being groomed by a woman teacher at the school to change her name, to change her dress, to become a boy. And when they discovered it, they complained to the principal. The principal said, well, this is totally on board with what I believe and what the school supports in policy. They didn't even bother to try to fight beyond that. They took their daughter and their son. They went south across the border. They found a safe house for a couple of weeks, planned a return to India, and they moved back to India and had the girl and the son continue to grow up in the community from which they left to find a better life in the U.S. They de-immigrated, like detransitioners, in order to detransition their daughter, because they knew that that was the only way that they could succeed as parents. This is really sad. This is an immigrant family coming for a better life and finding that they have more freedom back in India than they do in the United States. If that's not an indictment of how far we've fallen, I don't know what is. So you may be forced to leave your country, to leave the state if it gets that bad. And I would say as a parent, your first and only obligation is to save your child, not your home, not your job, not your reputation. If you fail, if you lose your child, you have failed as a parent, period. That has to be your primary consideration.
Yeah. Great. So as we end up here, thanks so much, Mark. We're so happy you're going to be able to come to the conference.
Delighted. Looking forward to it.
We're so excited to get your testimony out. And now Jordan Peterson has a little competition.
I'd love to interview Jordan on our podcast because I agree with so many of the tenets that he ascribes to, and he's such an inspiration.
Yeah.
And I quote him frequently because I try not to steal ideas. I try to replicate them and always give credit. And a lot of my ideas do come from him.
Well, we're gonna pray us out. Dr. Dozier, can you pray us out? But before we do that, is there anything we can pray for you about?
Oh, my. That's a surprise question.
Your wife would be able to answer very quickly.
Yeah, exactly. I know. The last thing I think about is my own well-being, which is probably a failing on my part. I'm always thinking about other people.
That's godly character, sir.
I don't even mean it in a virtuous way. It's just character flaw. I am so blessed right now to be in good health, to have wonderful friends, excellent colleagues, to be able to continue to work and speak and write and travel, to manage my podcast, to continue to write on Substack, my Dissident MD Substack, and to reach so many people. It's difficult for me to find something significant about which to complain.
So by the way, how can we reach you, by the way?
If you don't remember anything else, remember Dissident MD. Dissident MD is my website. Dissident MD is my podcast, my Substack. It's where you find a link to the podcast, which is called Informed Dissent. And Dissident MD is where you can get links to my book, my writing, basically soon to be my travel schedule. I'm going to put that up soon. So I think that the best place to look for all things Mark McDonald is just to, other than Googling my name, is just to go to dissidentmd.com and you'll find everything you need there.
Dr. Dozier, go ahead.
Father, we thank you, we bless you, and we honor you. Your goodness and your mercy. We thank you for gracing us to me on the air at this time. And I pray to those who will be hearing this podcast, I pray that they will be informed, enlightened, and impacted. And I do pray for Dr. McDonald. I pray that you will continue to give him wisdom and knowledge and understanding and guidance and even protection, Lord, as he steps forth courageously informing and leading away, Lord God, being leading charge in helping parents to see that there is a way of escape. And even as we leave this podcast today, I just pray for everyone that's on this podcast today and that you will give us all your mercy and your grace and your power to continue on. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Amen. So,
thanks again, Dr. Mark, for helping us to see how and why we can fight for our children and helping us to maybe help us to believe that we're real.
Hey, folks, this is Dr. Kevin Cruz giving you another pump because guess what? The Supernatural Junkies are on Rumble. All you have to do is go to Rumble, go to search, and when you search for channels, you look for Supernatural Junkies, and all of our stuff is going to start popping up. It's great because you're going to be able to see the links. You'll get to see exactly why we are saying what we're saying. But most importantly, this is a great way to share with your family and your friends exactly why we are living in prophetic times and why we cannot give up access to our bodies.
Hey, folks, it's Dr. Dennis from Supernatural Junkies. I just want to talk to you today about Protandim. I've been taking Protandim for a few years, and you know what? I feel a difference. I am younger than my age. At least I think I am. Anyway, Protandim is a strong antioxidant producer in your body because what it does, it causes your body to increase its glutathione production. And glutathione, folks, is the strongest antioxidant your body has. So if you want to keep strong antioxidants in your body and be a healthier you, I suggest you use Protandim.